This week on Your Western Context, we talked about U.S. tariffs, $50 billion to provinces for illegal immigrant housing, and the federal government's purchase of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and all these impacts on the economy. Also, we discussed the party platforms in the Ontario election on June 7th. This is Western Context, Episode 71, recorded Saturday, June 2nd, 2018, Holding Government to Account. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in again once this week. Welcome back.
It's good to be back this week. We've got a full show this week. We are, of course, talking about a major event that's going to be happening in the middle of next week, along with some other stories that have cropped up over the past couple of days that have had some very interesting impacts on Canadian life as we know it.
That is indeed true, and you know, this week started off as one of those weeks where we were saying, you know, we got the Trans Mountain Pipeline decision coming on the 31st. If there's no other news, let's just do a bit of an Ontario special, because that is indeed what is coming next week, the Ontario general election, and we are going to do that. So this week, you guys are in store for a mega episode of Western Context, because there's just so much news that needs to be discussed. So what we're actually going to do with that is we're going to sit here and we're going to provide you with all the context and information necessary to put you on the right side of the news. But also with doing that, we aim to remove the bias and sensationalism that the media puts into their stories and most often obscures the true facts of what is actually going on in the news this week. So you ready to begin?
Let's begin.
All right. So this week, most of the media and the government too seemed blindsided when the United States announced that there would be steel and aluminum tariffs placed on Canada, and not only just Canada, but Mexico and the EU as well. Previously, when these tariffs were put on the world earlier in the year, Canada, Mexico, and the EU were exempt from them, and these tariffs are 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum when Americans wish to import our goods. So you might have been alarmed with headlines, you know, reading online such as the U.S. triggers global trade war. And, you know, you might think it's a trade war on the surface, but after you look into the actual actions that happened, I don't think we're going to be calling this a trade war at the end of this story. But anyways, let's go on here. So first off this week, full of emotion, Justin Trudeau called the tariffs totally unacceptable, saying, "We have to believe at some point common sense will prevail. Americans remain our partners, our allies, and our friends. This is not about the American people. We have to believe that at some point common sense will prevail, but we see no sign of this with the action today by the U.S. administration. These tariffs are an affront to the long-standing security partnership between Canada and the United States, and in particular to the thousands of Canadians who have fought and died alongside American comrades in arms." And he, of course, pointed towards World War I and World War II and Afghanistan. And, you know, that was a little bit of an odd side note there, bringing this back to a military relationship when military and trade relationships are entirely different. Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland also piped in on this, saying that the government is planning retaliatory measures, as she called them, which will take effect on July 1st. And our retaliatory measures, according to her, will account for $16.6 billion in imports of steel, aluminum, or other products that are subjected to the new tariffs. So now for comparison's sake here, in 2017, the U.S. exported $341.2 billion worth of goods to Canada, and the U.S. imported $332 billion worth of goods from Canada in 2017. This means that Canada has a trade deficit with the United States of about $8 billion. So you might be wondering, what is a trade deficit? A trade deficit is the amount by which the value of imports exceed exports. This $16 billion amounts to roughly 5% of the total trade between the two countries. So, you know, it's not an insignificant amount, but it's not not a huge amount at the end of the day as well. It's not upwards of 50%. That just would not be feasible. So Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland also said, "This is the strongest trade action Canada has taken in the post-war era. It's perfectly reciprocal. This is a very strong Canadian action in response to a very bad U.S. decision." Now, Canada and the United States have a great relationship, but in general, our economy is small compared to that of the Americans. Retaliatory measures are not the correct action that should be taken today by our government. Canada has a GDP of about 1.5 trillion US dollars, and the US GDP has a value of about 18.5 trillion dollars, and of course that's in American funds. So as you can see there, Canada's economy is relatively small compared to that of the Americans. So these measures are purely political, and the true reason for these tariffs was ultimately missed by most of the media due to the theatrics of our federal government here. And when you think about it, and you compare the $1.5 trillion to $18.5 trillion, when you're dealing with economies that are that far apart in terms of actual scale, you have to wonder, how is a $1.5 trillion economy going to harm an $18.5 trillion economy? And that's why these retaliatory measures don't make sense, because this is the equivalent of trying to use a gust of wind to knock down a brick wall. It's just not going to work. So with this being said, back in March, a piece on the actual economics of steel was published in the Financial Post here in Canada. And among its findings, it found that demand for steel dropped sharply after the 2008 recession, which I think everyone can expect after a major recession that put into question many of the old school manufacturing industries, such as the auto industry. But in the recovery following the 2008 recession, the amount of steel producers globally has sharply increased. As of 2016, the global steelmaking capacity was 2369 million metric tons, compared to a demand of 1628 million metric tons. This surplus is equal to double the steel production of North America, Japan, and the EU combined. So with this being said, you might be wondering, where is all the steel coming from? Well, the answer is that it's actually coming from China. And we know that China in the modern era is a fast developing country, and a developing country is going to focus on bare metal industries such as steel and mining and ore. And when it comes down to that, they have no problem doing that because they can afford the environmental concessions along the way. So the report here also talks about the European Commission ordering Belgium to recover 211 million euros in illegal aid that boosted that country's steel makers. And you might be wondering, okay, why is that illegal? Well, Belgium is a part of the EU, and it is not allowed within the EU constitution for countries such as Belgium to compete with other European Union countries and receive this kind of illegal aid to their steel makers. So, moreover, in Canada here, a House of Commons Trade Committee report last June warned that Canada's steel industry can compete, but only on a level playing field. And that's going to be important going forward with this, that level playing field. Now, the committee went on to say that the global excess of steelmaking capacity and the resulting dumping of foreign products into the country have hurt Canadian steel producers. So now we're hearing a similar story to what the U.S. president is saying, is that there are countries who are not competing fairly, and this is actually hurting the steel producers of his country. And in general, we might very well be in the same situation here in Canada based on this House of Commons report. So knowing what's going on here, it makes more sense as to why President Trump is targeting the steel industry. Now, you might be thinking, okay, Canada really doesn't provide that much steel to the Americans, you say. Well, there's also something else that's been going on, and we've talked about many times on the show here in the past, and that's something else is NAFTA. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico have been trying to renegotiate NAFTA for a long time, since the middle of last year, but the talks are progressing slowly, and they're roughly only one quarter of the way through all the clauses that need to be squared away. Now, everyone needs to remember that Donald Trump, when he was running for president, ran on a platform of fair trade and ensuring workers in the United States got their fair shot against foreign competition, and in his view, NAFTA jeopardizes that. And we also need to remember with this that the U.S. midterm elections are happening this fall. And for those of you guys who don't follow American politics closely, this means that all of Congress and one-third of the Senate are going to be up for re-election this year. So with no NAFTA deal in sight, the Americans have to do something on trade, and this is it. So while the media may paint Donald Trump as unstable and vindictive through these tariffs, NAFTA is the entire part of this equation and not just one part of it. We also need to look at Canada's various industries as well. Our dairy sector resides under something called supply management. Supply management is a set of is an agreement where the dairy industry sets a collective price for Canadian dairy farmers and adjusts milk production and other dairy goods, their production levels, to meet consumer demand at the specified price. This in itself is a very protective measure and has been one of the sticking points in NAFTA, though we wouldn't really know it based on what we hear all the time when NAFTA negotiations come up from our side of the border. Most often we hear about progressive trade policies such as gender, climate, First Nations, and other rights like that that are very important to Justin Trudeau.
It should also be noted that supply management is very close to the same sort of procedure that OPEC and oil-producing countries do to protect their own oil production and to set their own prices on oil, which a lot of Western countries, including Canada, have actually criticized. So it's definitely almost hypocritical for governments to be trying to set up their own supply management on certain industries while criticizing other governments for doing the same thing.
Yeah, and you know, you might not have heard about supply management before, but we brought this issue to the forefront last year in the Conservative leadership race because Maxime Bernier, who is from Quebec, actually ran on a platform to get rid of supply management. And up until he ran for that leadership position, most Canadians had not ever heard of supply management. And when you think about it, you're entirely right that it is very much like an OPEC style cartel, and that is in its very nature very protectionist of our dairy industry. And you know, when you think about it, that has been one of the issues with our NAFTA negotiations. We also have the issue of a lapsed softwood lumber deal with the United States that expired in 2015 but hasn't been resolved despite NAFTA being on the table. Back in December, the U.S. put tariffs on Bombardier aircrafts of 292%, but these were later overturned. So why the tariffs in the first place? Bombardier was subsidized by the federal government in the past. So with these cases in Canada and the EU and the EU steel markets in particular, we can see why these tariffs are in place, and no one should be surprised if we had the full story of what was actually going on here. And what's more, the media based a good deal on the reporting on Donald Trump simply changing his mind. They simply viewed this as a knee-jerk change in terms of him deciding that he wanted to change his mind and maybe do something else. But in reality, this should be seen as a larger part of a negotiation. The media didn't get this, and they insist that we aren't charging the Americans higher prices for our dairy, for example. But in reality, our restricted markets for agricultural goods is effectively creating a higher price for Americans to get into our industry and thus creating an unfair advantage in the eyes of the Americans in our dairy industry. So if the media wants the true story on this and Canada wants to know what direction to proceed in going forward, they should ultimately just look at the president's Twitter feed, and it's all laid out there. He tweeted, "Canada has treated our agricultural business and farmers very poorly for a long period of time, highly restrictive on trade. They must open their markets and take down their trade barriers. They report a really high surplus on trade with us due to timber and lumber in U.S. And of course, the media being the media, the emphasis was on that last sentence fragment, due timber and lumber in the U.S. And I'm guessing that is related to the question of whether or not if Canada wants to get its timber and lumber into the United States, because those have been subject to tariffs as well with the absence of a softwood lumber deal. So as you can see here, if you look at this tweet, it shows precisely the direction that the government should be going on this to ease these tariffs and not focusing in on $16.6 billion in retaliatory measures. One final thing on this, a NAFTA deal was reportedly close, but now the prospect of two trade deals, one with Canada and one with Mexico, is being floated. And with this, we've seen similar pullbacks recently in regards to the North Korean summit. That's now back on. So extrapolating what we've seen on the U.S. president from this, it's likely that this is an attempt to reach a better deal and resume negotiations at the end of the day. And this is precisely why retaliatory measures are not the correct response on this, and the correct response should be to go back to the negotiating table and look at some of these tweets regarding our dairy industry.
Yeah, that's right. And I think something that is missed in all this is with the increasing tariffs that are going to, that the retaliatory tariffs that are going to be put on American goods, all that's going to do is make the cost of imports go up to Canadian consumers. And let's face it, we import a lot of goods from the United States that we cannot easily get from other places because both the EU and Asian markets are very far away, and it's a lot tougher to get to bring in goods from those markets than it is to get it from the United States, who we share the land border with, of course. So things like a lot of agriculture that we get from the States, such as fruits and vegetables, a lot of things such as more specialized electronics that come straight from the States, that's going to have a higher impact. So when it comes down to it, a lot of Canadian consumers are going to be paying a lot more for what they are buying in stores these days, and makes you wonder how this is going to impact a lot of other American businesses that deal in Canada as well, and what they're going to do with their prices to try and work around the tariffs. Because as we've said so many times before, when you increase taxes on a corporation, all they do is find other ways to make up for that cost, and that's either by increasing prices or by reducing it on their employees. And I think in this case, it's probably going to result in a price increase.
Yeah, and there's a perfect other way to combat this, and the answer is not to retaliate, it's to open markets and reduce barriers to entry into the Canadian economy. And I think that that's something that's missing, as we see here, that the first thing that the government puts out on this was an emotional response. The opposition isn't even standing with the government on this, and they view this as a problem with the Trudeau government as well, and not necessarily one with the United States. So that part was also kind of missing from the media reporting on this, but
And one more thing as well is the media reporting on Justin Trudeau's response. A lot of the topics floated out online and on news media has been in praise of Justin Trudeau for his response and how they view that he is standing up for Canada and Canadians. But when you look down to it, when he's saying that we have to believe that at some point common sense will prevail, we see no sign of that with this action today by the U.S. administration. They're basically saying that the U.S. Political leadership lacks common sense. And in diplomatic speak, it's very much a way of trying to insult Donald Trump directly, which, when it comes down to trade negotiations, when you have such a economic disadvantage with a country, it's not the best move to do, I would think,
Yeah,
because
1.5 trillion versus 18 trillion.
exactly. And one further note on this, just the fact that the media is praising Trudeau and his response on this, when they are the ones that have failed to actually get a deal done on NAFTA, it makes it very hard to actually praise him for anything that he's actually done.
Yeah, and you can see that as well in the tweet. I mean, do timber and the lumber in the US. That was the core focus of that tweet, not the actual fact it was focusing on the agricultural industry and that it was highly restrictive. And anyone who knows the economics of Canada will know supply management, and that is, by economic nature, a very restrictive economic practice.
Indeed.
All right, what's our next story?
So our next story is talking about a story that just came out yesterday, and that was that the federal government will provide $50 million to provinces most affected by the illegal asylum seekers, which of course have been walking over the U.S. border ever since January of last year. Now, Quebec, which has seen the majority of the asylum seekers, will receive $36 million. Ontario will receive $11 million, and Manitoba $3 million. And these are designed to help pay for some of the costs of providing housing for these asylum seekers while they wait for their refugee claims to be processed. So, Immigration Minister Ahmed Hussein made the announcement on Parliament Hill, saying that the money is just a first installment in a longer-term funding arrangement, meaning that more millions of taxpayer money will be transferred at a later date. Hussein said in Ottawa on Friday, quote, the the continued influx of asylum seekers entering Canada between ports of entry has increased pressure on provinces to provide shelter and social services to a growing number of asylum seekers. We appreciate the pressures Quebec, Ontario, and Manitoba are facing, and will continue discussions with provinces towards longer-term solutions, including further financial support. So these longer-term solutions do not appear to be financial support towards either deporting these illegal asylum seekers or enforcing our border with the United States. Now, Quebec has asked for $146 million from the federal government, saying that it needs to cover unanticipated asylum seeker costs. In a tweet Friday, Quebec Immigration Minister David Huertel said that the federal government's announcement is its first concrete recognition of the province's efforts to deal with the border crossers. The federal government is working with Quebec and Ontario to develop what they call a triage system that would move some asylum seekers to areas outside Montreal or Toronto, where many of them have already settled as they await the outcome of their refugee claims. Now, this is something that Transportation Minister Mark Garneau was talking about, but he said that they're not going to actually be able to fully develop a plan on this until the Ontario election is concluded next week, because they are not sure if a certain party gets elected, if they will follow the federal Liberal strategy on this. Now, Toronto Mayor John Tory has issued a statement calling the $50 million a start towards the federal government meeting its responsibilities to cities. Toronto alone expects to incur $64.5 million by the end of 2018 in direct costs relating to providing motel housing to refugee claimants, and anticipates spending another $6.3 million on emergency contingency sites, he said. He also mentioned that, quote, our city has a long history of welcoming refugees, and we will continue to support that approach, but we have been clear that Toronto can no longer absorb the costs and impact of the increasing number of refugee claimants coming into the country at this time. So one of the sets of emergency contingency sites that have been created to help house these asylum seekers have been colleges and universities, as well as the homeless shelter system in Toronto, and they've all been opening up their residences to asylum seekers. Most recent statistics show that there are 2,779 refugee claimants in Toronto's shelter system. Of course, those are increasing daily, and those are including hotel and motel programs specifically serving the refugee claimants. Now, it's actually found that the asylum seekers represent nearly 42% of the entire shelter population, which is causing a lot of strain on services that are designed to help Ontario's and Toronto's more or less fortunate population. Now, BC NDP immigration critic Jenny Kwan made a statement. She was wondering why BC, which has seen 153 asylum seekers cross between official border posts this year, was left out of Friday's funding announcement. But one has to think that the relationship with the BC government and the federal government is not exactly warm at the moment, and we'll, of course, be talking about that in our next story. Now, Ahmed Hussein will soon travel to the United States for high-level talks with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen to discuss ideas he has to help modernize the Safe Third Country Agreement. They include possibly introducing the use of biometrics to allow border officials to better track the movements of individuals to determine if they are eligible to make a refugee claim in Canada. Now, one wonders how Hussein thinks the U.S. will help with this problem, given the sudden chilly relationship between Trump and Trudeau over trade. Now, conservative immigration critic Michelle Rempel called the cash announcement a band-aid solution and predicted that the money requirements for housing, healthcare, and other social costs will continue to climb as the flow of asylum seekers crossing into Canada from the U.S. continues. She said, what we've heard today is an abdication of responsibility to manage our border and our asylum claims system effectively. Now, Rampell has repeated her demand that the government apply the Safe Third Country Agreement to the entire border. She said declaring the whole border an official crossing would close the loophole that's driving irregular border crossings. The STCA requires asylum seekers to make their claim in the first safe country that they arrive in unless they qualify for an exception spelled out in the agreement. But the agreement applies only to claimants trying to enter at official land boarding crossings by train or at airports, which is why a lot of people are making the trek into Canada by foot outside of official border crossings. Now, she said the Safe Third Country Agreement still doesn't apply at an illegal crossing, so Hussein can biometric all he wants. The agreement still isn't going to apply unless he broaches the issue of renegotiating it.
So this story, you know, caught us by surprise because, you know, we have two of the biggest stories of 2018 so far this week. We have the decision on the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and we have the issue with trade. And then here we are. We have the government giving out $50 million to help cope with these illegal asylum seekers coming into the country in Quebec and in Ontario. But at the same time, there is no real discussion going on about how this is going to fix the issue going forward. I don't think throwing money at the problem is going to fix it.
No, exactly. And that's something that's mentioned even by a lot of the other provinces. Quebec has mentioned that it would need almost three times that amount of money just alone to be able to handle all of the people that are coming into the province. Toronto is at its limit, and without further tax increases on Toronto's population, it's not going to be able to sustain anymore.
And that would not be fair, further tax increases on Torontonians.
Exactly. And it's also causing problems in other less populated areas, such as in Manitoba, which when it came down to the media, they mentioned that Manitoba was getting $3 million, but not, they didn't really talk anything else about Manitoba whatsoever in the media. And certainly BC was missed on this as well. And we get our fair share over the border right between Vancouver and Seattle, of course. And I think something else that was missed in this is what exactly this is going to help, because the money is going towards housing and healthcare and other social programs, but there's no end in sight to this. All that's going to happen is more people are going to be coming over, and now there's money that's going to help them. So, of course, that's going to entice more people to come over. So there's no end goal to this, and there's no plan in place for the future either.
And this is why, you know, 18 months in, we have not seen an actual solution that will fix this problem. None of the solutions that have been proposed fix the actual problem. They attempt to push the problem further down the road. And when the weather gets better and when it becomes summertime, you see the influx of migrants coming over the border. And at some points, you just need to wonder, at what point are Canadians going to say no more? And that's why this needs to be dealt with very quickly. And we talked about this last week as well. Canadians are generally very accepting. But there's going to be a point where this becomes a national issue, not just in Quebec, Ontario, Manitoba, but a national issue. And, you know, I don't know that the media is going to know how to report on that based on their track record so far. So we'll have to watch that going forward.
Indeed.
Our next story relates to the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and this feels like something we've been talking about forever. I know we did a count at one point, and we were talking about this for 5 weeks in a row earlier this year. So it's back on the burner again this week because, as you all know, back in April, Kinder Morgan announced a work stoppage on the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and we knew that there was a problem with that. Pipeline protesters have been chaining themselves to gates and machinery throughout this entire process. MPs Kennedy Stewart and Elizabeth May have been arrested. The BC government insists that they're simply undertaking reviews while not standing up for the project. The Alberta government first banned wine and later brought in legislation to cut off the flow of gas to BC, but both are on the table, but only after been prodded by the opposition here in Alberta did we actually see both of these options come onto the table, even though it doesn't look like at this point the gas will get shut off towards BC. The federal government has been insisting that the pipeline is in the national interest, but they took no concrete action to move the project forward, similar to the issue that we see with the illegal asylum crossers in Ontario and Quebec. The federal government could have evoked Section 9210C of the Constitution in declaring the project in the national interest, and that could have moved it forward all the way, but they neglected to not do that. Following that, this week, the announcement, $4.5 billion by the federal government to buy the existing pipeline. And this is the number that has been reported in the media this week, $4.5 billion. But it's most often lost in the fine print that this $4.5 billion is just to buy the existing line that already exists. You have to read further into the articles to see that Kinder Morgan estimates the cost of building the expansion to be an additional $7.4 billion. The federal government this week said in addition to buying this, they will build the new expansion for this amount, and Bill Morneau insists that the project will not have a hit on the books. So you have to think to yourself, when was the last time that the federal government had a project come in under budget? They have the Phoenix Pay scandal as well. They can't even get their employees paid properly, and that system also incurred cost overruns. Kinder Morgan has lost confidence in the project, and that's why it's now in the hands of the federal government here in Canada. The only way this project will get built is because the federal government has more money, though that is, of course, taxpayer money at the time, and effectively unlimited time, though probably not, considering we do have an election in a year and a half. The purchase of this project changes nothing. Protesters are still free to chain themselves to the machine and interrupt the work that goes on at the worksite. The only difference here is that the losses will no longer be those of Kinder Morgan, but will be the losses of the taxpayers. The Alberta government is prepared to pay up to $2 billion to indemnify the project in exchange for future equity. You might be wondering, what does indemnify mean? Well, to indemnify something provides security or protection against loss or other financial burdens. So to sum this all up, the federal government will pay $11.9 billion for this project at the bare minimum. Alberta will pay $2 billion for this project if this ultimately goes to plan, with chance of taking equity at a later date. This is, in effect, a liquidation of toxic assets. A change in ownership doesn't make the project more viable, it just increases the number of resources that are available. When dealing with toxic assets, there are only two real options here, and those are either to liquidate or make the asset in question profitable. As we're dealing with the federal government that can potentially borrow billions of dollars, we must hope for the second that this project will become profitable at the end of the day.
Now, what would toxic assets be referring to there for those who are not in the know about economics?
Basically, what it means when you are referring to toxic assets are something that no one wants to touch. They're toxic. So that effectively means that the private industry doesn't want this because they can't make a profit off it. They can't sell it to anyone because those people won't be able to make a profit off it. And the amount of money that would need to be put in to make these toxic assets untoxic would simply be too much for anyone to bear. We saw similar kind of things happen with the 2008 financial crisis, where no one in the private industry or the stock market area would want to bail out the banks or even the automakers in the United States. And as a result of that, we saw huge taxpayer bailouts to companies like GM and Ford. And that was, in effect, there a liquidation of toxic assets, moving the toxic assets of these companies and banks towards the government of the day, mainly the American government. So according to Danielle Smith of 770 News in Calgary, climate change, gender equity, First Nations rights, and making sure Quebec gets a share of procurement could make the project balloon past $20 billion. So with that being said, we need to remember that Canada could have had this project for free, at least monetarily, in terms of the fact that taxpayers wouldn't have had to pay anything for it. A new Crown Corporation will be set up to oversee the pipeline and construction, and at a later date, this will be sold off. Reportedly interested in buying the pipeline once it's complete are First Nations groups along the routes and pension funds. Both of these have already expressed interest in the project. Now, you might be wondering, pension funds, that's interesting. Okay. Well, of these include the BC Government Employees Pension Fund, which ironically includes the pension of BC Premier John Horgan. So in effect, this pipeline could very well be funding the retirement of BC Premier John Horgan when he's done in public life. So with all this in mind, let's just remember that this government has an issue with the numbers. Budget deficits of billions of dollars were more than anticipated when the 2015 election campaign was underway. Remember, they forecast teeny tiny deficits that really didn't come into play. Huge cost overruns for a skating rink in Ottawa we've seen in the past, as well as we just talked about here, millions of dollars to handle those crossing our border illegally. So this government does have an issue with numbers, and given past trends, there's no reason to assume why this pipeline project will come in under budget to the Canadian taxpayers now. So, you know, as we might be thinking that this project is now finally nearing construction and people appear jubilant, as did Premier Rachel Notley this week, this is just the beginning on this road, witnessing the trials and tribulations of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, because nothing has effectively changed since last week.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people are saying that this is a good thing when they're forgetting that now everyone in Canada, no matter what your views on pipelines or oil resources or what you feel about the protesters in Burnaby, doesn't matter because the government's going to be paying for it, and all that's going to do is be coming out of our taxes. Whoever pays tax in Canada basically are now paying for Trans Mountain Pipeline. They're not just paying for the expansion, but they're also paying for the original pipeline as well. So this is something that is going to not only cost the federal government to continue to go under in the deficit, it's also going to make it harder for them to stop that deficit and return to a balanced budget. And it's also going to mean that we're just going to be paying more and more debt servicing costs on that deficit as well. So not only do taxpayers have to pay for the pipeline, we also have to pay for the money that's going to be paying for the pipeline as well. So there, it's almost like a tax on top of a tax.
Yeah. And this, and you know, no one has used the term toxic asset to describe this pipeline yet, but we are definitely heading into that direction with this. And, you know, when you think about it, the very definition of toxic assets means that the asset in question cannot be sold. And when you are dealing with a national economy, the only people who are going to be able to pick up a toxic asset are the government. And that's what leads me to believe that we are heading into that path for this pipeline project. And I mean, when you think about it, there is no assurance along the way anywhere here that anything will change with this. So in a way, this is just the government spending, you know, $13 billion today and potentially upwards of $20 billion once everything is all said and done to build this thing. So the issues with this are just beginning.
Indeed. And it's something that can't be understated, is that this is not a good path forward for this pipeline. The better path forward would be to let private industry take care of this, take care of the costs, and work with them to protect the environment and all the other problems that the BC government had come up with. And this was on the federal government to negotiate this, and they failed to do so when all it took was for them to either create a fund that would help against any potential oil spills, or to have some sort of revenue sharing project with BC to be able to have a bit more going towards BC for having this pipeline. Now, the federal government failed to do that, so their response is to buy the entire pipeline. It really makes no sense to me and to a lot of other people, but yet the media has been talking about it as if it's such a good thing. And I think we've just described it's really not.
That's right. All right. What do we got for our next segment? here.
So our next segment here, we're going to talk about the three major political parties in Ontario, which is the Ontario Liberals, the Ontario NDP, and the Ontario Progressive Conservatives. We're going to outline each of their platforms, talk a little bit about what they're promising to do should they win the next provincial election, which is going to be held on Thursday, June 7th, and to talk about how they plan on managing the economy's finances, because as you know, I live in BC, Shane lives in Alberta, but it's undeniable that the largest province out of Canada has a very large say in how the direction of the Canadian economy goes. So what affects Ontario ultimately affects the rest of us as well. And that's why it's a very important issue to talk about. So with that, we're going to start with the Ontario Liberals. And they, of course, have been the party that's been in power since 2003, when Dalton McGuinty first won over the Progressive Conservative government of Mike Harris. And Kathleen Wynne has now been the premier since early 2013. And it's expected that having been in power for over 15 years, the Ontario Liberals are expected to have some baggage. Now, Kathleen Wynne has had a very negative reputation that's just continued to snowball over the past couple of years, despite winning an increased majority in 2014. Now, her own personal approval rating has been hovering in the mid to high teens, which is terrible, absolutely terrible for a leader to have. And now, just today, just a couple hours ago, Kathleen Wynne has announced that she agrees that she will no longer be the premier after the June 7th election. Now, she's encouraged voters to elect Liberal candidates to prevent either the NDP or the PCs from securing a majority. So it's very likely that she will resign after the election, no matter what happens. So there's not really that much point in talking about the Liberal platform, because they even their leader has agreed that they won't win the election. But here are a few highlights anyways, and kind of just to talk about what they've been doing over the past few years. So I went to, of course, the Liberal website, because we always want to go to the primary source when we're talking about a story. But they've got all of their promises hidden behind 45 separate pages, which neither I nor most people have the patience nor dedication to peruse. So the pages all have flowery titles such as promoting equity or supporting innovation in the new economy, the reconciliation journey, and supporting multicultural communities. So there's quite a few different topics that they're going to talk about in each of their subsets, but 45 is a lot of different, it's almost overwhelming how much they're trying to throw at you without trying to sum it up and whatnot. So instead, here's a quick summary that's been provided by McLean's on a lot of real issues in terms of the economy when it comes to Ontario. So on the provincial debt, the Liberals have pledged a bevy of increases to social services, healthcare, and childcare, all of which will send Ontario into the red again. Now, with more than $20.3 billion in new spending, which is planned over the next 3 years, as announced in their 2018 budget, the Liberals now project annual deficits of between $6.5 billion and $6.7 billion until at least 2020, until 2021. Now, under budget 2018, Ontario isn't projected to return to balance until 2024-2025, although the province's Auditor General has actually dismissed these projections and has said that deficits are higher than they are stated right now and will continue to grow rapidly. So we'll see that on the provincial debt, the Liberals do not have a plan to return to balanced budgets, and they are continuing to increase spending towards social services, healthcare, and childcare, among other things as well. So we're going to have to see how they continue to work on that. Now, on taxes, approximately 8.6 million people would roughly pay the same amount of income tax, but $1.8 million would, or 1.8 million people would pay an average of $200 more, while close to 700,000 would see an average tax cut of $130. Now, there's no changes to the corporate tax rates, and so we're going to see that more people are going to be paying more in taxes rather than less, even though we're still not on a path towards a balanced budget with the Liberals. So with Hydro, the Liberals face an uphill battle to impress voters. Hydro has been one of their major failings in that a lot of hydro rates in for regular Ontarians have been ballooning, and it's just something that's been going up and up over the years with no end in sight. Now, the Liberals are offering a 25% cut in hydro bills with larger savings of 40 to 50% for rural communities. They also include the Affordability Fund, which was launched last October, that would help Ontarians to buy items that would improve home and energy efficiency, including LED light bulbs, greener appliances, and better insulation. So in this, they're talking about making it so that homes are more energy efficient, and they're trying to create a fund for that, but they're not actually doing much to actually cut hydro bills, even though they've promised that they would. All that's going to do is going to make it so that you'd have to end up paying it more on the taxes that would come in through the government. But the government would be taking the hit on this, but since we're already in a deficit in Ontario, it means that they would just be paying more and more to service the debt costs. Very similar to the federal Liberal plan, which would cause more and more debt as well. Now, for health, the Liberals plan to pour money into healthcare. They've said that they're going to invest 82 or 822 million to bolster hospital healthcare, increase registered nurse numbers, and to introduce a drug and dental plan to cover 80% of costs to consumers. Now, this was one of the things where the Liberals have talked a lot about is on increasing healthcare, but unfortunately, under their regime, healthcare has actually fallen a little bit by the wayside. Wait times in hospitals has ballooned by quite a bit. There's been a lack of beds in hospitals as well, leading some opposition parties such as the PCs and NDP to talk about the hallway healthcare that Ontario provides, which is basically trying to do healthcare in the hallways of hospitals without beds. So this is something that the Liberals are going to have to continue working on and to be able to be able to try and fix as well, when over the past few years they have not been able to do so. Now, when it comes to energy, the Liberals have planned to spend $1.7 billion over 3 years to support energy-saving programs under the Green Ontario Fund. They want to invest more money into progressing Ontario into what they call a more competitive and low-carbon economy. So what they're trying to do is invest more into projects, regardless of profit, that are going to be able to support the green economy that they want to create. So rather than supporting initiatives that will be profitable and provide value for money, they're wanting to create what they would call a competitive and low carbon economy. So they're trying to balance the environment along with their economy. So there's not actually any energy projects in mind that they have that they're going to try and fix. But it's going to be something that we'll have to see what they do, because over the last few years we've seen this shift into the what they call the green economy, and it's not really been helping out their jobs, and it's not been helping creating competitiveness. And while we're talking about energy, should also mention that they do not want to cut either corporate tax rates or small business tax rates. So they're not really making Ontario competitive when it comes to the economy. So as we can see, the Liberals do not really plan to balance the budget, and they want to introduce billions into social programs And they also want to continue their focus on their version of the green economy while they're not increasing jobs and corporate competitiveness. So even Nguyen knows that voters won't buy that on June 7th because she's even stated that she doesn't think the party will win the election.
And when you think about it, I don't know if there's been a case recently where a party is effectively throwing in the towel a week before an election in Canada.
No, I don't think we've seen that ever. I've been talking to a few people today about this, and none of them can even recall a time where a party leader will just give up before an election even happens. A lot of times, even when they know that they're not going to win, they'll still campaign hard because they've got an obligation to their candidates and to their party to try and do the best that they can. But in this point, Wynne is just giving up at this point, and she's trying to say, vote for us to stop the NDP and the PCs from having a majority.
Well, I mean, it could also be a personal reason for her, but we're not into mind reading on the show. But next up is the Ontario NDP platform, and a little bit of a background first on the background of Andrea Horwath. She was first elected as an MPP in 2004 in a by-election, and she later won the leadership of the NDP in March 2009. Under Horwath's leadership, the NDP increased its support in the 2011 election and maintained this level of support through the 2014 election. So, as you might have heard, and we have seen dueling polls in the past year, in the past couple of weeks, that show the NDP and PCs changing positions for lead. We really don't like to talk about polls here at Western Context because they're just a snapshot in time. It could be inaccurate, but the NDP wants to sell Ontarians on a 5-point plan providing drug and dental coverage for all, ending hallway medicine and fixing seniors' care, cutting hydro bills by 30% and renationalizing Hydro One, also converting student loans to grants, thereby reducing debt, and protecting the middle class by having the wealthiest people and most profitable corporations pay their fair share in taxes. And that's what that last bullet point there means. Probably we're on the horizon for some tax increases with the NDP should they become elected in the Ontario election next week. The Ontario NDP will continue Liberals' cap-and-trade carbon pricing system, but will divert revenues to those who are, quote, carrying more than their fair share of the burden, which, I guess that's symbol for wealth transfer. Following the move of British Columbia, the NDP at Ontario will also introduce a speculation tax on housing for all buyers, not just foreign buyers. And they say they're doing this to cool the real estate industry and make housing more affordable in Toronto and surrounding areas. During the campaign, it was also revealed that the NDP made a $1.4 billion costing error in the party's platform. The party miscounted a $700 million annual reserve fund as revenue rather than an expense. And this means that the deficit would be a little bit bigger, according to Andrea Horwath, but they later expected that the party's platform will still be solid on this regard. The party's fiscal platform, you would think there might be a fiscal platform in terms of investment for capital projects or investment for infrastructure, but that doesn't exist. The term deficit or surplus is only mentioned once in the platform, and that's on the costing page. So it's clear, just like other NDP and Liberal governments, there will be no concern given to the amount of taxpayer money being spent in this platform, and I think we can see that by the costing error here. We've also talked about illegal immigration and the flow of migrants recently as just a couple minutes ago on the show here, and the Ontario NDP has their own plan to solve this issue, declaring Ontario a sanctuary province. The idea behind a sanctuary province or city is that people can claim basic services without fear, regardless of their immigration status, and the NDP calls this the decent and humane thing to do. What this effectively means is that if the NDP comes into power next week, the rule of law will effectively be suspended for any illegal migrants in Ontario. Now, you might be wondering, does this mean that if the federal government decided that the people who were coming into Canada illegally had to go back, that effectively means that the province of Ontario would be in the business of sheltering these people, regardless of what federal law says. And I think what you can distill this down to is the absence of rule of law in the NDP platform. So with this being said, you might be wondering, okay, so it sounds like the NDP wants to do a lot to help to help everyday people in Ontario. But we should also have a look at the candidates who are running for the NDP, because not many people do that. And that also didn't happen here in Alberta back in the 2015 election. So here's some examples. Joel Hardin is a pursuer of environmental justice. You'll recall that we talked a lot about justice and the NDP when we did our NDP leadership showcase last year. He also talks about the existential threat of climate change and wants a carbon tax starting at $30 a ton and increase it by $10 per year until 2030, which would bring it in line to be $150 per ton by 2030. This places it way higher than the federal government's carbon tax of $50 per ton, which will be in place by 2022. There's also Laura Kammacher. She won't wear a poppy as a symbol of remembrance because she feels it's war glorification. She is also a 9/11 conspiracy theorist and believes that the Americans are to blame. There's also Tanzlam Riaz, who praised Adolf Hitler online and said that our military, Canada's military, slaughtered innocent men, women, and children in Afghanistan. And finally, there's Gurtan Singh, who is Jagmeet Singh's brother, the federal NDP leader. He is an anti-police protester and participated in rallies with signs that said F the police. So these are just a few, but it's clear that among the many glaring policy holes that there are significant issues with Horwath's team, though no official response has been given on this. When asked about her team and cited with the numerous examples here, Horwath deflected rather than offering condemnation of her team, pointing to her platform and how life would be made much better for Ontarians if they elect the NDP next week. And when you think about it, that is not leadership. If someone under your command does something wrong, does something as vile as saying that the Americans were responsible for 9/11 or Canadian soldiers committed war crimes in Afghanistan, that's something the leader should attempt to stand up against and correct. But Andrea Horwath did not in this case. And ultimately, this is the same NDP story that we saw in Alberta and BC last year. The NDP arrives with a vision and idea, but their platforms are not thoroughly costed, their candidates aren't vetted, and a year after the election, many end up with buyer's remorse. And I think all that needs to be said here is that, you know, you mentioned, I think, that the Ontario Liberal platform was 45 pages?
Yeah, there were 45 separate pages for the Ontario Liberal platform, and it made it very difficult to navigate, so it was actually hard to tell what they were actually talking about.
Yeah, the Ontario NDP platform is 98 pages long, and buried in within there was the talk of sanctuary, and when you combine that with all of the other candidates that we mentioned and the costing errors, the Ontario NDP is NDP in as bright of an orange color as you can get, and I think that's the best way of categorizing the Ontario NDP in this election.
So basically, if you have an idea of what the NDP is, the NDP in Ontario are basically as NDP as NDP can be.
Pretty much.
All right, so let's talk about our last political party platform, and that would be the Doug Ford-led PCs. So much talk has been made over the past few days of the Ontario PCs party's lack of a platform. Now, a few days ago, the party finally released its platform with a few key spending details, but without full costing. Now, this has led many news outlets to report that Doug Ford's PCs have, quote, no economic outlook. And that's a bit of a reach to begin with, because they do have an economic outlook, and it's definitely a little bit of a different path than to what the Liberals and the NDP want to go for, rather than the continued deficits and continued spending on government and social programs. The PCs want to end up going back to that balanced budget. So having this platform not be released until just a week before the election, and then not having it fully costed until after the election, it's basically been a very bold strategy to get potential voters to focus on either Wynne or Horwath as bad alternatives without actually providing much in the way of a better alternative themselves. So it's been very interesting to see the PCs this election. It's been definitely a very unconventional campaign from them, and something that we haven't really seen too much from political platforms and from political parties that have been campaigning as well. So we're going to have to see if this strategy of theirs bears fruit over the next week. Now, the PCs have outlined five major goals for their mandate should they win. They're outlined on their on the PC Party website under the tag Plan for the People, which was, as I said, just released a few days ago. Now, I say goal more than plan because while the end game is clear on these, it's not entirely sure how the PCs actually plan to get there. So all of the following is straight from the PC Party website, unless I state otherwise. One thing I can say is that they've made their platform very easy to read and navigate. They've got main bullet points. All of it is on just one page. So that one page, if you printed it out, would probably be close to 8 or 10 pages. But it's a lot easier to navigate than either the Liberal or the NDP website. So it's actually easier to see what they actually plan to do. You don't have to click through anything. You don't have to read between the lines. It's all right out there, which it's very refreshing to see a political party actually do that, given the problems that we had with the federal NDP race trying to figure out their political platforms. So let's go over these five major goals. Number one, they call that put more money in your pocket. So they want to scrap the carbon tax, they want to reduce gas prices by 10 cents per liter, and they want to, what they call, give real tax relief to lower and middle class families. Number two is to clean up the hydro mess. So they want to fire what they call the $6 million man running Hydro One and lower your hydro bills by 12%. They also, number three, they want to create good jobs, which is to send the message that Ontario is open for business and to bring quality jobs back to Ontario by lowering taxes, stabilizing hydro bills, and cutting red job-killing red tape. Number four is to restore accountability and trust. They want to order a line-by-line audit government spending to bring an end to the culture of waste and mismanagement in government. And number five, they want to cut hospital wait times. So they want to end what they call hallway healthcare by creating 15,000 new long-term care beds over the next 5 years and adding $3.8 billion in new support for mental health, addictions, and housing. So let's go into these plans a little bit further. Let's see what they've actually talked about on their website on this. So on Hydro, the PCs plan to scrap the Green Energy Act, which was brought about by the Ontario Liberals. They also want to eliminate enormous salaries at Ontario Power Generation and Hydro One, and they want to stabilize industrial hydro rates through a package of what they call aggressive reforms. They also want to declare a moratorium on new energy contracts, and they want to renegotiate others where possible in order to achieve a fair deal for also the Ontario government as well as its people. Now, on infrastructure, the PCs want to expand the GO Transit train service, and they also want to support transit projects in other cities while expanding the subway system and work with the City of Toronto to do so. And they also want to explore high-speed rail and expanded highway projects. On fiscal management, the PCs believe that, quote, Ontario doesn't have a revenue problem, it has a spending problem. This is something that we've seen before when it comes to both BC and Alberta when it comes to the NDP governments there. Now, the PCs also want to launch an independent commission to find out about the deficit scandal and to propose solutions to remove the deficit and return to a balanced budget. The party says it will, quote, return to a balanced budget on a responsible time frame, but it doesn't actually say when that will happen, or the steps it will take to get there. But they also want to centralize government purchasing and to conduct a value for money audit of every government program to ensure that programs are not costing more than the benefits that they provide. On tax, the PCs promise to abolish the carbon tax and to oppose it at every step, including taking the federal government all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada if they try to impose one. They also plan to cut income taxes, gas taxes, and they also want to introduce a minimum wage tax credit so those who are working minimum wage pay no tax. They also promised to preserve rent control on existing tenants and to create a 75% refundable tax credits for childcare costs for children aged 0 to 15 and to, quote, respect parents by leaving them to make the choice of what kind of childcare is best for their kids. So reading between the lines on that one, they don't want to create a government-funded childcare system. They want to rather create more tax credits for people that are wanting to enroll their children in childcare. Now, when it comes down to jobs, the PCs want to make businesses more competitive, and in doing so, they want to cut corporate tax rates, small business tax rates, and to cut red tape and corporate welfare in order to save money while creating more jobs. They also want to increase access to apprenticeships, and they want to reform the foreign credential recognition process so that skilled immigrants can contribute more effectively to the economy and to get their credentials recognized. On health, the PCs actually plan to invest in mental health, addictions, and housing supports, and they also want to add more beds to hospitals, which will cut wait times. So this is something that we've seen with a lot of the other parties, is that they want to cut wait times as well. So they're not going to be doing much different from the other parties on the health regard. They want to actually invest into healthcare as well to make sure that Ontarians can go to hospital and actually get the health care that they deserve to have. Now, in other areas, they've also gone into planning on protecting the environment by making sure that revenue goes to fund conservation efforts. They've also talked about infrastructure projects in Northern Ontario, and a lot of tax credits go towards Northern Ontario. They want to develop natural resource projects. They want to cut the aviation fuel tax for Northern flights to allow people that are flying in between Northern Ontario to be able to get around more. They also want to cut income tax for provincial doctors that are going to be practicing in Northern Ontario to try and increase the amount of health care that is provided to Northern Ontario communities. So while we can see all the list of priorities that the PCs will make, and while it's right now yet unclear how they're going to fund all those promises, it appears that the PCs are the one party that believes in cutting taxes and balancing the budget. So after all this, we're going to be able to see who voters choose on June 7th to lead them.
And with that being said, I think the choices are really clear at this point if you have just listened to this podcast, because if you paid attention to the Kathleen Wynne speech this morning, you'll see that she has effectively taken the Liberals out of this race. So now it is a two-choice race between the Ontario NDP and the Ontario Progressive Conservatives. And I think when you distill all the policies down and all the choices and the vision that they have for province, it's a clear choice that can be made. And people in Ontario will need to be making that choice, and we'll definitely have an eye out for that next week's podcast. So,
yeah, I think just from looking through all of the three parties' platforms, we can honestly say that none of them are perfect, and while some of them are a little bit closer to being perfect than others, and there is very clear choice in who they can elect to make it so that the economy of Ontario comes back onto track, and that's something that we can see through the platforms, and there's been a lot of media misrepresentation out there, so I urge everyone to go to the actual political platforms, try and get educated and informed about their vote before they go to vote on the June 7th election, and I wish Ontarians luck with whichever government they decide to elect in the coming week.
And if you want to find the platform, you can find that in the full show notes at westerncontext.ca. All right, what have we got for Word of the Week?
So our word of the week this week is very apropos to what's going to be happening in Ontario. Our word of the week is election. Now, this is defined by the Collins Dictionary as a process in which people vote to choose a person or group of people to hold an official position of political power. So this is exactly what's going to be happening on June 7th when Ontario goes to an election. And we're going to be seeing more and more elections over the next couple of years, ones that are very important, of course. The federal one's going to happen sometime in 2019, as is one in Alberta, and we're going to be seeing more elections happening over the next few years, which will shape Canada in years to come.
All right, you're right. That is a very apt word of the week. But that pretty much wraps up this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes, you can find all the party platforms there at westerncontext.ca. You can also find all the details about the Trans Mountain pipeline purchase, as well as the $50 million for immigration and asylum seekers, as well as our notes on the U.S. Steel and aluminum tariffs, which were reported very badly in the media this week. So all that and more at westerncontext.ca. And if you want Western Context delivered automatically to you, you can subscribe to us on any number of podcast listeners, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Google Play Music, Stitcher, you name it, practically everyone under the sun. You can find out how to do that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And if you're interested in supporting us monetarily on this podcast, you can do that. You can visit westerncontext.ca/support to know what we're about and where the costs go. But just as in a general nutshell, the costs go towards server hosting, domain renewal, and research time on this podcast. So if you like what you're doing, consider supporting us on Patreon at westerncontext.ca/support or directly on Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where you can find all the stories that we post throughout the week and stories that don't make it to the show. They're all there, and you can share those with your friends and figure out what's actually going on in the media at Western Context on Twitter and Facebook. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll continue to make sure that we cut out the bias and sensationalism that we see every single day in the media out there. We'll give you the stories with the facts, and we'll make sure that you have the context to place you on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context. Have a good week, everyone, and good luck to Ontario.